Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the 16mm Film Crew podcast. I'm Cindy.
And I'm Dale.
You can watch us on YouTube. You can like and comment on our YouTube videos and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can listen to us everywhere podcasts are found at 16mm Film Crew podcast. Leave us a rating review and visit us on our website at www.16mmfilmcrew.com. This week, we watched The Taste of Things, directed by Tran A. Hung. Here is your synopsis. Cook Eugene and her boss Dodon have grown fond of one another over 20 years, and their romance gives rise to dishes that impress the world's most illustrious chefs. When Dodon is faced with Eugene's reluctance to commit, he begins to cook for her. And this movie stars Juliette Binoche and Benoît Magimel. So, Dale, what was your thoughts about this film?
This is one of the movies I was chasing down, like, before the Oscars, you know, when they released those international films, and during the film festival season, I was, like, searching to get a chance to watch it. It released on November 8th of last year, but it premiered at Cannes May 23rd of last year. I like if you're a big Ghibli fan, if anybody listening is a big Ghibli fan, and one of the key things everybody always says about those movies is that the food looks good. And this was also one of my drawn appeals of this movie. The movie makes food look amazing. But at its core, it is a wonderfully, like, well-written love story that's using the elements of cooking and, you know, the passion and poetry of cooking, which people don't really acknowledge a lot of times, the art of cooking and that side, and it interweaves those elements to tell a wonderful, wonderful love story.
Yeah, this is like a very you movie. Like, it's very funny. But yeah, I really thought this was so sweet. Like, this was just like such a sweet film. And I don't know. All of those dishes looked amazing. I did have to eat. I feel like we talked about this after we recorded last week, when I was like, every time I watch something that involves food, I do have to eat because I get hungry. And so I did have to eat during the watching of this film because I was getting hungry. All those dishes looked really good. However, if you eat like that every day, like, you're going to go to the hospital. Like, the cream and the rare meats. They were throwing cream on every vegetable. I was like, all right, y'all, how did we make it to this point? Like, that is a crazy amount of food to be eating, like, very rich food to be eating every day. But I think what was really sweet was, especially in that big opening sequence where it's just like them cooking the meal, and I think it's like supposed to be in one take, or it looks like something to that effect. I was like, okay, it's a really nice setup to, like, where you're going to go, where it's like, it's about food, but it's also about community. And I really, really like movies like that too, where it's like how this one thing can bring people together, because there's always people over at their house, like, they're cooking for other people. It's like very cute. Like, I don't know. I just liked it. And I also love Juliette Binoche so much. So I'm like, yes, I will watch whatever you're in. Like, I thought she was great. I thought everyone was great, actually. But yeah.
Like, I love how the movie does a wonderful thing at the end where it goes back and forth to, you know, them talking about their engagement and them talking about their relationship. And, like, and this movie summarizes, I think, what a lot of artists look for. Like, because even though he's a gourmand, which is a person who loves food and all that stuff, he also is a cook himself. So to have your equal in a feel or a hobby you enjoy, it's very rare you find somebody that you can bond and mesh with. That's why I see a lot of times in, like, Hollywood, you see a lot of directors and writers, you know, we talked about Noah Baumbach and Greta Gerwig, you know, couples like that who are of the same artistic mindset in a way, who also bounce ideas off each other for their projects. It's like, I remember in college, I had friends, you know, remember Art and Soul, who would say, yeah, I can't really date another poet because, you know, they're going to end up in my poetry. So there's sometimes dating artists works and sometimes it doesn't. I think this is one of the few times where you're dealing with, like, cooking and, you know, gastronomy and all that stuff where it really worked very well.
And fun fact, the main actors were together in real life and have a child. Like, what? That blew my mind. I was like, what are you talking about right now? But yeah, they were like in a relationship for several years. Not recently, like not when the film was being made, but like way back in the day. And have a child together, which makes the chemistry between those two really like cement because and like really prominent in the film. Because like from the first kind of moments of their interaction, I honestly thought that they were married. Like I didn't know that they were just like living together and working together and that like there was an idea that they might be into each other. They might actually get together, but it never really happened until like we're starting to see the film. So like wherever the film starts is like when things start to move for them and their relationship. And I thought that that was really sweet. And also because this movie takes place in like Victorian Edwardian era where like, you know, the standard was that you got married and then lived with your person for however long, had a whole bunch of kids. And I think it was kind of modern for them to be in this relationship, but not like have ownership over each other in that way. Yeah. Like I like that one of the last lines is she was asking him, you know, am I a cook or your wife? And I mean, the sad part of it is that they never actually get to get married, but he's like a cook. And that's what she wanted to be like for him. Like she didn't want to kind of just be his property or like dressing in his house. Like she wanted to be his equal, as you were saying. And the fact that she resisted marriage for so long, even though like everyone's like, you guys should be together. And he's like, we need to be together. Just shows like her independence, but also that she also really wanted the relationship as well. Like she talked a lot about like hoping that he would come to her room and stuff. So, and I like that it's not like a weird view of feminism in the way of like, oh, you don't want to get married, then you don't, you know, like men or something crazy, like some very old fashioned way of looking at it. It's very much like, no, I want this relationship, but I don't want the ownership that comes with it. And I think that for them to even have that discussion in that time period was very kind of forward thinking in a lot of ways.
Yeah, you could tell that their relationship was not the norm, I guess, for the time period, because especially at the end after they have the party and their friends leave and she's like, the friends are like, why don't you bring her upstairs and have her talk to us and spend time with us instead of just you? And she's like, no, the art of cooking, you would spoil it for me, because when you've eaten, I've already tasted the food in my head, and all this poetic and lovely language describing her passion for cooking. And then the two of them just eat together outside, and he like asks, oh, can I come to your room later? And she was like, they basically talked about consent in a way. Mm-hmm. And when they brought up the idea of marriage, he was like, she said, basically the fact that, oh, if we're married, you're not going to ask my permission. And he was like, no, I always ask for your permission. Like stuff like that. Like you mentioned, like, because this is like a very Victorian Edwardian time period where relationship roles, even today, people are still figuring out to have them for 20 years. We both like each other, but you're my cook, you're my boss, that kind of thing, and still able to separate the two and still have a loving relationship with each other is really amazing to see play out on screen.
Yeah, that was very modern. I really loved the way that this relationship was depicted. Honestly, this movie is so good, like how it was shot, but also like the atmosphere that they were able to build, where it's like, oh, I kind of want to just go to the countryside of France now and like, you know, and eat some very delicious food. It kind of made you want to be in that world, which was really nice. I love it when directors really know how to set the kind of environment of the characters so well, where you want to, where you're not only drawn in, but you like, you want to be there. And I think that Tran, who directed it, did a really good job at that. But also when there's like delicious food and it looks like beautiful and nice outside, I think that's going to happen. I feel like in every movie where they have things like that, it's like, yeah, 10 out of 10. Like, sure.
Like the cinematography, I thought in this was like really beautiful, and it's not surprising. Like, you know, Tran, he said his influences were, because he's Vietnamese, he's French-born Vietnamese, he's like, his influences are French cinema and a lot of, you know, Japanese filmmakers like Kurosawa and stuff like that. So he's like the perfect blend of both those really different artistic styles. Like, if you look at those old Japanese pictures, they're very heavy on the story elements, and the European and French cinema tends to be very focused on the visual aesthetics and cinematography. So I feel like this movie was like a perfect blend of both those worlds. Like, you could tell he's really a student of those elements. And the thing with me with this movie, watching it, like, I don't know if you've heard of the phrase like cottagecore kind of thing.
Of course I know,
like,
that.
Like, that spoke out to me. Like you said, I want to, like, get a little cabin in the woods somewhere where, like, my little wood stove and just start chefing and stuff. Like, so picturesque. And I love the fact that they kind of showcased his wealth, but hid it very well by mostly featuring it in the kitchen, because based on their circle of friends, he is, like, almost a French aristocrat, because he's preparing food for a prince and stuff. And his circle of friends is doctors and stuff. And even the circle of friends also regarded her as an individual. And that's another layer to it. Like, my mom has a saying of, show me your friends and show me who you are. The fact he also surrounded himself with people who acknowledged her gifts and talents on an individual level is another thing on this movie that, you know, you don't see very often.
Yeah, I thought that was great. That's what I'm saying about how, like, modern this film is, because it, even though it is a period piece, like, the themes in it and how everyone's treated in it, it is very progressive in a way that, I mean, I don't know how progressive it was back in those days, but you would hope that there would be at least one family that would, you know, be kind and respectful of women. You would hope so. But yeah, I also, to your point about his wealth, it is true, because it's like, most of it is in the kitchen. And it's only when you go upstairs, when she is able to be, you know, a diner, and, like, he is, you know, making the food and giving it to her, where you're like, oh, these rooms are, like, beautifully decorated. And I honestly thought that this was a different set. Like, I didn't know that we were still in his home. So I was like, oh, okay, you got it like that. Eugene, like, let's get married. Like, come on. You earned it, girl. You earned it. Like, you did your thing. But yeah, I really did appreciate. And I feel like watching this right after we watched Perfect Days is nice. Like, if you wanted to do a double feature, it's like a nice double feature, just because it does remind you of, like, how beautiful and simplistic life can be. Like, when you just focus on the core things. Like, I know most of us know that food is kind of the thing that gathers people together. It creates community, it creates conversation. Like, and it's also an art form, but it does have that kind of power to rally people. And, like, even if you don't agree on certain things or whatever, like, you can always agree if the food's good, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that setting it where it's mostly about, like, you know, you growing your food in the garden and all the animals are there, and then you're kind of just sourcing it from the earth and you're making food together, it does remind you of, like, the simple pleasures and beauties of life. One of my favorite parts in the movie comes towards the end, where Eugenie dies, and it's like, we couldn't have figured this out. I was really upset. I was actually mad.
20 years y'all been at this. Come on, man.
Like, what? And, you know, he's getting different cooks to come in and seeing if they can make the recipes, you know, and no one really can. But my favorite part was actually the young girl, Pauline, who they are, like, training as, you know, as apprentice. And the fact that she was... It's almost like when Eugene died, there wasn't a replacement for her necessarily, but there was, like, someone who could fill a piece of his heart in Pauline, like, and be that kind of next generation who's going to come up and, you know, do really great things. And I love that they saw potential in this young girl and actually followed it up, you know, like, let her actually do the thing. Again, very progressive, very modern. I love how women are treated in this film. It's great. But Yeah, and I really liked that, like, he incorporated her so much in it, where like they were gonna go find the next chef, and they were like, "What are you doing here? Come on, let's go." Yeah. And I was like, "Yes, I love it."
I love that too. Like she only spent like one day with them, and that was the beginning of the movie where they had the big old party, and she's there with her cousin eating food and trying, and her like. And that's the thing with mentorship, like, people don't realize. It just takes one thing, and you could see as she's tasting the food, and she's like, "Oh, I feel hints of this." And you see her eyes opening to the world around her of, like, food. And, though, like, both of them are impressed by her natural talents, and they're like, "No, she needs to come live with us now to cultivate these skills." And mm-hmm. she's passionate about it. Like, after Eugenie dies, she's, like, begging her parents, like, "I still want to go." And Dothan, he's still apprehensive. He's like, "I'm not as good a cook as her. I don't think it's a good idea." Mm-hmm. But like you said, his heart, like her being there warms his heart as they're trying foods for different chefs as he's preparing for his event. And I really love that because at the end, I was like, "Oh, they're going to not have her anymore." She's like, "Oh, I get to try this food now." He's like, what are you doing? I'm not leaving. Yeah. Come on. And she just scampers out the door. That was like so heartwarming to me. It's like he found that little piece, like you said, of Eugenie in her and still brings her along with it. And I love that so much.
It was so good. Like just the thought of like having someone invest in you like that really... Again, this movie just really warmed my heart in such a sweet way. Like, it really made me happy because I was like, you know, even though Eugene's gone, there is someone who's still here who has something to offer and has something to contribute in this man's life, as well as developing her own talent and skill. And I just thought, lovely, like, just absolutely lovely. Like, this movie is lovely. Like, I don't...
It's not just that. They're both healing because her parents come to him like, "Yes. Yo, our daughter has been sad since, you know, Eugenie died and she still wants to come." Like, they both find mutual healing to fill that gap, which, yeah, it's...
Yes. Yes, that's exactly right. And also, like, how food and preparing meals together can be a source of, like, therapy. Like, and like, you know, of coming together and healing. This movie's deep. They hit us with so many things on so many different levels. Like, they really did it. It's great. I don't know what else to say other than, like, this movie is amazing. Like, I don't know what else to say.
It is amazing. I will acknowledge, though, for a lot of people, like, because this movie is French, and we watch it with America's English subtitles, like, and there's a lot of talking in this movie, and because it is in French, I don't think people will pay full attention to it. But if you get the chance to, like, focus in on this, like, it's just 2 hours. It's a wonderful, beautiful movie, you know. And I really hate that it took after the Oscars everything for me to have an opportunity to watch this movie, you know, because it was only in French. Like, you have to scamper the webs to find it. But yeah, this is a beautiful movie. Like, in watching it, and as I'm doing these, you know, international films post Oscars, I'm really blown away. I'm saying there were a lot of good international films this past year, you know.
Yeah, I think Tran won Best Director at Cannes for this film. Yeah. So like,
yeah.
There's always good stuff. People are always making good stuff out there. I really do believe that. And I feel like we have always proponents of, like, just turn on the subtitles, but also make these movies more accessible. I really feel like more audiences should have the opportunity to watch movies like this because it's not, because I mean, you can understand how people can go to the movie theater and say, you know, there's not really any good movies out. Like, what happened to Hollywood? What happened to cinema? Blah, blah, blah. And I just feel like if these movies were, you know, kind of given more space to, like, be seen, and if people are more willing to just put on the subtitles and watch it, then I don't know if we would have that same opinion. I feel like that opinion would start to shift. So,
yeah, I think that's where those memes have come, like, of, like, people who do, like, film students and film theory and film critics, they always talk about these far-flung foreign films, which, yeah, I do love those too. But because the average person is not going to know to search out those films, you kind of come off as snobbish. But they're everywhere. Like last night, I was just chilling in my room, and I was like, okay, let me go to HBO Max, and like it had select like a full collection of like French films. Like I think honestly, it's the interpreter. Like just there are ways to watch it. Just take a chance.
Yeah.
And that's all it takes. And you'll find a whole, like, there's nothing wrong with, you know, loving action movies, loving comedies, but the film space is so, like, diverse. Not even just languages. There's art house films. There's a lot of good pictures people are refusing to enjoy because they don't want to come off as snobbish or they don't want to look like a regular person. So they kind of barrier themselves off to certain corridors of the film space.
Yeah. Do it. That's our wrap up. Do it.
So while we're still on the topic of these international films, of course, Oscars were a couple weeks ago, and a lot of drama has come out of result of actual Best Picture winner. Jonathan Glazer, who himself is Jewish, made an impassioned speech in his acceptance over what's going on in the Middle East as far as Israel and what's happening in Gaza. And released earlier this week, there apparently was a letter from 1,000 Jewish creatives and professionals kind of denouncing him, as reported by Variety. The signees include Deborah Messing, Amy Pascal, Eli Roth, you know, a bunch of other attorneys. But the group goes on to say, we refute our Jewishness being hijacked for the purpose of drawing a moral equivalence between Nazi regime that sought to exterminate a race of people and the Israeli nation that seeks to exert his own, avert his own extermination. Jonathan Glazer hasn't said anything about it. But remember, I don't think he really cares what American Hollywood people think because he makes stuff in like Europe and England. So he's like, I don't really care, like for the most part. But for me, the most erroneous thing about this letter and Variety reporting it was the knowledge that, A, they did include the link to the letter. But not just that, the letter actually appears to be a simple Google Doc form that doesn't ask people to confirm either the proof of their, I guess, Jewishness or their professional background. And the issue was, Variety also included the link to that form in their initial article, which in their current rewrites of it, they have removed it. And of course, they no longer included in the massive readout of the list of names. There was one pretty obvious fake name as far as River to Sea, which Palestine from the River to the Sea, that name was removed from Variety's reporting of the list. But if you scroll through, there really is no real confirmation of people. Like some people have WGA, SAG, SAG-AFTRA, you know, what union they're with, but a majority of the list just has first name, last name. So I really feel like it's kind of really disingenuous for Variety to report without actual confirmation of who these people are and their representation in Hollywood. Because I can go on the list right now. The Google form is still active and I could throw my name on there. There's no like real vetting process. But another creative has come to his aid, Tony Kushner. He himself has said what's going on to him looks like ethnic cleansing. And if you don't know who Tony Kushner is, award-winning playwright, you know, frequent collaborator of Steven Spielberg. And he's come out in defense of them. And, you know, and he basically says, you know, it's impeachable and unimpeachable and irrefutable. Like, he's on Glazer's side. He says what's happening is so simple that Jewishness, Jewish identity, Jewish history, and history of the Holocaust and the history of Jewish suffering must not be used in a campaign as to accuse a project or dehumanizing the slaughter of our people. It's misappropriation. So it's good that even on both sides, there are kind of people within that community who are fervently, like, picking a side that most people don't agree with, but there are still other creators who are like, no, nothing is wrong. And they voiced their opinion publicly instead of, you know, silently on a piece of paper on a computer screen, which, you know, yeah. And Tony Kushner is like, if you don't know, he's, like I said, collaborated with Steven Spielberg, but he's one of the biggest Jewish names in Hollywood as well. But yeah, it's, I just don't agree with the Variety's, you know, reporting of, you know, innocuous names, you know, without a vetting process. Like, we learned in school, like, cite your sources, you know. So yeah, I don't agree with Variety's reporting of the Glazer situation properly at all.
Yeah, I saw this story, like, well, I guess came out last week or something like that, and I saw a couple of different places. So, like, the reporting of that there had been this cohort of Jewish people in the industry who had signed a letter against Jonathan Glazer and his speech, that was already out. Now, I didn't know about the linking of like the Google document and how anyone could just like write up in there. And I mean, it doesn't surprise me that there are voices in Hollywood who are very much pro-Israel, and they don't, like, they're not going, the idea that they would support anything Glazer said or any of the politics around like what is happening right now, obviously that, I mean, we've talked about it on this show. You probably have seen it on social media. Like, you know that those voices are out there. My thing about this is that, like, as I was watching Zone of Interest, all I thought about was Palestine. So yeah. I feel like the fact that Jonathan Glazer came out and was making those comparisons made a lot of sense, because how can you not think about it in this film? Like, it, he's clearly showing you that this is what happens when you take certain steps. Like, when you go too far, when you dehumanize other people, like, stuff like this happens. And, you know, I feel like there are certain Jewish voices who refuse to believe that, like, anything could come, like, in comparison to the Holocaust, and, like, nothing should ever be compared to that atrocity. And it's like, well, I understand, like, I get your point of view, but also, like, do you not see what's happening in Gaza? Are you just choosing to ignore it? Like, or choosing to just keep your stance? So I feel like he was completely right to say what he said when he won that award. Like, that made the most sense to me.
And his stance is not surprising, you know, like you said, because if you are on social media, you'll see the clear dichotomy of, you know, you see Jewish people saying, oh, I'm so scared to go out, driving their car, getting pizza, going shopping, but they're scared. And you have, you show scene footage of Palestinian people searching through rubble, like, picking up grass to eat. That parallel really much exists in Zone of Interest, where the one side committing the atrocities is having a regular day, talking about, oh, I got to get dresses and shirts and stuff, while beyond the wall, unhidden, people are suffering. So even cinematically and paralleling the real world, like, he was always going to have that side of an opinion. So, but
right. It's, and I'm, yeah. And like you said, I'm glad that there are Jewish people who are like, no, he was right for that. And there are a lot of Jewish people who completely agree with what, like, who understand, like, what's going on in Gaza is absolutely wrong. So I'm not going to paint with the broad brush here at all. Yeah. I'm just saying, like, there are certain voices in Hollywood, especially those voices who have fired actors for speaking out against Israel for what they've been doing. Like, you know, there has been real consequences for people having a stance on this. And so I feel like this is just like another one of the thing in the, like, another issue in that kind of continuation of, like, people having very stringent views on something and then also trying to, like, ruin people's careers over it. Like, I'm glad that Jonathan is still doing his thing. He is an Oscar winner. Like, he's fine, but it just goes to show you, like, how far people are willing to go to, you know, have their opinions be the opinion on the matter. So anyway, moving on to our next story. Anne Hathaway recalls missing out on roles over how toxic her identity had become online. So Anne Hathaway is doing a new movie with Jessica Chastain right now. I think it's called Mother's Instinct. And so she's had an interview with Vanity Fair, and she was talking about that moment. I think it was in 2012 or 2013 when everyone just started to hate her. Like, the Anne Hathaway hate was real. Like, she did Les Mis and people didn't like that. And then she won the Oscar for Les Mis and people were upset about that. And then she hosted the Oscar with James Franco and everyone hated her. Like, I don't know where, I don't even understand, like, and I lived through that time. I don't even understand what happened. Because I was like, first of all, Anne Hathaway, Princess Diaries, like, Anne Hathaway has always been that girl for me. And I couldn't believe, like, what was happening. And I didn't understand why it was happening either. But the fact that it had such a negative impact on her career, where people didn't want to hire her, that is insane to me. Because it's like, well, you didn't do anything wrong, first of all. Like, literally did nothing wrong. Just was talented and did well in her career. And then got so much hate that people didn't want to work with her. And I'm like, well, she's still talented. So what does that mean? I don't know. But then she says that Chris Nolan was really like an angel for her, who gave her that role in Interstellar. And that really helped kind of keep her career going. And I love Chris Nolan for many reasons. But one of the reasons is that Chris Nolan is, he likes a comeback kid. Like, he is very into like the underdogs. If you just saw what happened with Robert Downey Jr., not that Robert Downey Jr. was an underdog by that point, but you know, he had some struggles in his life.
Kind of was, to a degree. I mean,
he was doing Iron Man. Yeah. He's very wealthy.
Yeah.
So like, was he really struggling? Not really. I guess like in terms of artistic work, we weren't seeing that from Downey, but he's a superstar. Like, come on. Anyways, he still likes to give people chances to like reinvent themselves. And I think that is really cool. Like, I really like that Chris, I don't know if Chris was paying attention to what was going online. I don't even think that man has a phone. So like, I'm not even sure if he knew what was happening, but I think that he does maybe have like a talent of like spotting people who can really be uplifted and transformed in his roles. And that's great. Love that. For Anne, like, I'm so happy everyone is obsessed with Anne again, because I just feel like everyone should have been anyways. Like, why did we stop? I don't get it.
Yeah, I feel like the vitriol against her was kind of not necessary. Like,
completely unnecessary.
Like why? Like, and it's one of those actresses we've grown up watching who's been successful. And I think a piece of it might be people just being bitter, you know?
Yeah, I think so. Bitter, misogynist, and terrible. So, anyway. I don't really have any more news other than I think Scarlett Johansson might be in the next Jurassic 4 movie. Jurassic World. Jurassic World Part 4, the remix. I think she's in that one. She's in talks to be in it. I stopped watching that movie, so I in like...
Yeah, I'm...
In not, the sequel.
I'm not...
So... And also Scarlett Johansson, like, what are you doing? Like, I feel like she just no offense to Scar Jo, but like Scarlett used to make some really interesting stuff. Like, she was in a Jonathan Glazer movie called Under the Skin. Weird movie. Yeah. Like, Scarlett, you are talented. Like, you don't need to, are you just trying to get a bag? Like, I'm not sure what's going on over there.
I think Scarlett should just probably, I think there's two things about it when, and this is probably why people got bitter against Anne Hathaway to a degree, is for most of her career, Scarlett Johansson was doing a lot of indie films, you know, Woody Allen movies and stuff like that, a lot of Sofia Coppola movies, and Marvel was like her like big break in a way for some people. And post-Marvel, she hasn't really had as many roles as her male co-stars. Even, you know, Mark Ruffalo, who wasn't a big player in it, is in Poor Things, you know. Chris Evans could pick and choose what he wants to do now, you know, because of the gravitas of being Captain America. Robert Downey Jr. is always going to be Robert Downey Jr., you know, post-Iron Man. Like, the only other cast member in that circle who's not in anything is basically Jeremy Renner. Who, you know, wasn't really a known quantity before, but I think he's okay with it to a degree. So I think that's probably also a factor as well. Like, even Daisy Ridley has speaking out about it. Like, she assumed post Star Wars, like, she'd get a lot of roles, and that hasn't happened. And I also think Hollywood still has yet to figure out when these actors do these big IPs, especially if you're a woman actor, a woman or actress, I should say. that once you've been attached to a major IP and you want to do other work, it's the opportunities don't come as much as the ones for your male co-stars. Like Carrie Fisher transitioned into being a script doctor, working behind the scenes on movies, rarely being seen in front of the camera, you know? So yeah, I don't think that's something Hollywood needs to work on, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. All right. So what have we been watching this week?
For me, of course, I've mentioned numerous times, I'm a big motorsports fan. I watched the Dan Weldon documentary called The Lionheart. If you don't know, Dan Weldon was an IndyCar driver from England. He died October 11th. Not October 11th, October 16th in 2011 at Las Vegas Speedway in a race. And the documentary basically covers his upbringing from England, you know, wanting to do F1. And F1 is really hard to get into if you don't have the funding and transitioning to do IndyCar in the States. And it's set against the backdrop of his kids, his two sons, you know, who were, I guess, like three and a newborn when he died. They're transitioning into becoming professional race car drivers as they move up the go-karting ranks. And it was wonderful. Like, and is you see the relationship of his wife, you know, raising these two boys without her husband, and these young men are struggling with the idea of going to races and their father's not there, and they're both having to deal with the therapy. And it comes to a head at the end where their race for the ending of the season is at the racetrack their father died. And like throughout the movie, you're watching the boys not really want to express the emotion of not having their dad around during the season, especially after, you know, Michael Andretti, who was one of the owners for his father, signs them to a development deal, you know, so they're around, like they're becoming around their father's friends more often now in that circle and dealing with, you know, coming like, oh, the season ending race is where dad died. And you finally see the boys like just release all that stuff they've been carrying in for like years, probably, as they've been doing this. And their mother just, you know, when she hears the news, like breaks down to her son's comforter. Like, it was like beautiful and moving to see. And it also goes to show like a lot of these athletic pursuits that a lot of young men and women have are family careers, like whether it's racing or, you know, acting to a degree or for it. Like once you're in that environment, like you feel like that's what you want to do no matter what, no matter the negative impact that would happen to your parents. Like they knew their father died driving and they still want to drive. You know, we mentioned before The Crow, you know, Brendan Lee, his dad was an actor and a martial artist. He's like, oh, I want to do that too. You know, all those things kind of go out the window when you want to follow the passions, or not just that, feel like that's the only way you can live up to your parents' memory. But yeah, it was a beautiful, moving picture to watch. Like, you know, hear some of my favorite IndyCar drivers growing up. But yeah, beautiful picture. If you're not a fan of racing, but you're a fan of documentaries, I would still give us a go. This movie also might make you a fan of racing as well if you're not in watching it. But yeah.
So I watched the All Quiet on the Set docuseries, which documented Nickelodeon in its heyday and Dan Schneider. Oh, Lord. This was really difficult to watch. I think sometimes when you watch certain documentaries, it's not easy to watch, but like you can kind of understand it as like just history. Like, you know, well, back in the day, it wasn't that great. And, you know, there were certain things that should have been put in place, but they weren't. So that's why X, Y, and Z happened. Like, I watched a documentary about eugenics. Crazy thing that happened for real. And like really changed people's lives and still has a huge impact on immigration and how we see people who come from other countries. Like, so, but in my brain, I'm like, well, you know what? I can contextualize that as like, you know, that happened in, you know, the late 1800s. I mean, the late 1800s, early 19th century. I don't know if that made sense, but like, in that time period, like 1890 to like 1920, 30, stuff like that. So I was like, okay, well, you know, that's a part of history. And I'm glad I know what happened and like why certain things are the way they are now. Watching this was awful because this was my childhood. Like, yeah. This is the stuff that I grew up on. I know these people. I know these faces. I know these names. And so that felt totally just awful. I was watching my childhood just like die slowly. And it's not because I didn't already know about some of these allegations. Like, I think Dan Schneider, his name has always kind of been in the ether of being just a creep and a weirdo. Like, I think that was already out there. Not when I was growing up, but like a little bit later. And also because of Jeanette McCurdy in her book, I kind of knew what was going on in terms of like how things operated at Nickelodeon. This goes way deeper than that. And then it also reveals so many different things. And I just was like, there were three pedophiles who worked in Paramount for Nickelodeon during that time. And the way that I'm like, y'all, you're working with kids. Like, I can't, it seems so unfathomable that there weren't enough checks put in place to make sure that people like that never interacted with children ever, because that is what this network is. It's a network for kids, starring kids. So it's just so deeply irresponsible and disgusting that three of these dudes were able to walk about set and really damage children's lives. Like, it's just so, like, Drake Bell was one of the victims of one of these dudes. And I feel terrible because Drake, if you know what has happened to him recently in recent years, has gone through a lot, has been in his own mess. And when you're looking at it from afar, you're like, wow, what happened? You know, these child stars, you know, they always end up in these kind of situations. And then when there was a whole episode that was just dedicated to him and his story. And I was like, I can't believe that happened to you. Like, I'm so sorry. And it completely explains like how you can end up in a situation where you're doing things that are reckless and possibly hurting other people because of the damage that was done to you when you were a child. And I feel like everyone's known this about child stars. Like, they a lot of times are the only people who are, they're like the money makers of their family. So they're supporting their entire family and their kids. Yeah. They're in an adult environment because they're working all the time. And then they're not being protected because everyone's kind of out for their own self-interest and kind of seeing how they can use this kid to get whatever they need. And it's just really sad. Like, we already know that. But when you really like see what has happened to these kids and how they've grown up, especially when you were a kid watching them as kids and now you can see them as adults, like, it really is just the saddest thing. Like, totally, totally sad. And how women were treated in that industry. And I'm like, damn, like, this is awful. Like, Disney hasn't come out and we don't know what happened over there, but maybe one day somebody will make a documentary about all of that.
Yeah.
All my childhood will go down the drain. Yeah.
And it's, I like, I can't say that was my childhood. I think that's more so my early, like, adolescence, teenagers.
Yeah.
But I do remember the beginning of, like, the last couple All That seasons, mm-hmm. where Amanda Bynes was on and she also had her own show and she was growing in profile there. But yeah, it is sad to watch or even be aware of, because we assume, like, okay, we have all these labor laws protecting children in Hollywood that these things shouldn't happen. And it seems like the people in power at Paramount, as the more successful Dan Snyder shows got, the more they let him do whatever he wanted to do, right, without any checks and balances. Like, when you brought up Disney, like, I don't know if anything will happen, because, like, it's, I think the only weird group of Disney stars that have talked about stuff are, like, the kids from Ned Declassified. Or is that Disney?
That's Disney, right? That's Nick. Yeah.
They be telling they sex stories too often. I don't want to be hearing that. But I know Josh Peck, you mentioned Drake Bell. Mm-hmm. I know Josh Beck has a podcast talking about this stuff, and he interviewed Hillary Duff, and he was like, man, I was like, the perks, all that stuff. And she was like, I never had those problems. And Josh was like, dang, I should have joined Disney, because all your Disney kids sound perfect. Like, there's no issues. Except for, like, I guess Lindsay Lohan to a degree. But
yeah,
we don't know what happened behind the scenes with Disney, because we know a lot of the racial issues that happen, especially dealing with, you know, Raven Simone behind the scenes with her issues with her show. So, and she was Disney's main breadwinner for a long time, still is, you know. But yeah, children are not protected as much as we think in Hollywood at all.
It's terrifying that the rule was like, your parents must be with you at all times. Because it's like, okay, well, what does that mean? Like, and the fact that the parents were often like shepherded off of set so that the kids could kind of be just like in the clutches of these people, is just, it's awful. And I think the difference between Nick and Disney, and I think why Nickelodeon kids probably had a lot more, again, we don't know all the issues. Like, I know stuff happened with Demi Lovato and stuff over at Disney. So stuff was happening over there.
Yeah, stuff was happening, yeah.
But I think for Nickelodeon, their whole attitude was like, well, we want to push the boundaries. Like, we want to kind of make shows that are for kids, but can also be for adults. Like, I remember I would watch Drake and Josh with my dad. So, like, they were making shows that kind of catered to older audiences, which means that they could be more suggestive about the material that they were putting out there. And I feel like creating that kind of environment where you're asking your children actors to say and do really adult and explicit things under the guise of comedy just creates an environment of like anything goes. And Dan Schneider, they gave that man whatever he wanted. And the fact that a lot of these guys who weren't arrested and put in jail are still able to work, like, it just, I guess it shows you another thing of like where the priorities are. Which we already knew, but I think post Weinstein, kind of in the Me Too era, you would think that people would move a little differently. But I think for Dan Schneider, they just gave him millions of dollars and
make hits and call it a day.
And he's not, you know, he's not working with them anymore. But like, if he wanted to do something else, he could. Like, there aren't really any true consequences to these types of behaviors. It's just like, just take some hush money and go away for a little bit, and then if you want to come back later, you can.
Yeah, nothing would have stopped Dan Schneider other than the court of public opinion on rumors and stuff like that. You know, have this documentary series not come out, he could have said the next, in like before this documentary series came out, like, oh, I want to start another kids production company, and investors would be lining up behind him. And you spoke about Jenny McCarthy and her, like, and your suggestiveness of adult, like, themes. Like I remember, I think my sisters were watching, like, I think it was Victorious or whatever with Ariana Grande. Mm. And they had, like, an addiction joke where she's, like, addicted to, like, popcorn or something.
Yes, I remember,
like,
that
kids
one.
Aren't going to get those kind of things. And, like, I remember seeing too many, like, feet jokes. And I think that's also where it started with Dan Schneider. Like, your shows have too many feet jokes, and the people doing the feet stuff are young women who are underage. That's kind of suspect. And I remember reading, like, Amanda Bynes didn't want to do the series because she probably had to deal with it the longest at that Nickelodeon group. But also, like, the person I also want to hear from as well is Ariana Grande herself, like, because she has transitioned out of that Disney or Nickelodeon child star mode and is successful in her own right, you know. And she would be probably a very powerful voice in getting out whatever happened to them behind the scenes on set, you know, based on her prominence. So, but that probably won't happen because she doesn't want to rock the boat, you know, too much. But
I wonder what she has to say about it. I wonder what she has to say. I wonder what Miranda Crossgrove and Victoria Justice and all the main people in that circle, I wonder what they have to say about it. Now, are they going to say anything? Probably not. Like, if they did, if they were going to, they would have said it in the documentary. But it is unfortunate because it's like, I feel like there are certain people who had a really close and good relationship with Dan Schneider who don't want to ruin that, even though, because even though he did some really shady stuff, and I truly believe, especially from this documentary, that he has a true hatred of women. Like the way that he was treating the women who was on his writing staff. Crazy. Absolutely wild. So he does not respect women. I know that for a fact. Like that's what this showed me. And so I feel like the women that he was close to, like Amanda Bynes and like Ariana Grande and the other folks, like, I don't know how they're gonna feel about it. Cause even Drake Bell, when he was talking about what had happened to him, he said that Dan Schneider was the one who helped him out throughout the entire thing. And so he never had like a bad word to say about him. So I feel like there are certain people who have very good relationships with this man. And because he didn't do anything criminal, they're probably not gonna say anything.
I mean, and it's not just that, it's also the fact that Paramount is still Paramount. You know, all these, like, being a young actor is hard, like, post-child star. Like, we joke about Kenan Thompson being on SNL forever. Mm. But he, like, it's obvious why, like, oh, he was a child star. He knew the struggle of finding work. He's like, oh, I'm on SNL now. That's a consistent gig. I'm not leaving this. Yeah. So, you know, struggle, like, and these kids, well, they're adults now, still acting. Paramount's still a big production company, you know, with mm-hmm. millions of IPs. Like, they don't want to sully, even though the issue might not be with Dan, there are other people in that circle who are probably doing stuff who still have positions at Paramount that they kind of have to play the game with, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's very true. That's very true. Oh, bless these people. That's I feel so bad for them. That's awful. I'm so sorry that they had to go through that, because yeah, terrible. But yeah, so that's it. That's it for this week. We hope that you guys are doing well. Make sure to check out all of our social media. Support us if you can. And we'll see you guys in the next episode. Bye.
Au revoir.